Welcome to Shared Ground, where we meet to explore the lands and forests of Eastern Canada, Mi'kma'ki, and our relationships to the rest of nature. We talk about many interconnected issues as we explore the incredible value of thriving forests, as well as methods and mindsets for interacting with and within them in mutually beneficial ways. One of the main purposes of Shared Ground is to hear opinions and ideas from many different people. Nothing presented here is intended as the final word. Each perspective will hopefully lead to a better understanding of a bigger picture. I am Amanda Bostland, and I am in search of ideas, practices, and attitudes that support the well-being of all species for whom these lands are home. I believe in the importance of finding shared ground, where as humans, we can live well and meet our needs while contributing to thriving ecosystems and all the incredible life we share this planet with. I am grateful to be living in Mi'kma'ki and recognize that this is the unceded and ancestral territory of the Mi'kmaq people. This episode is a compilation of three past Shared Ground episodes around the themes of action and collaboration. For this compilation episode, I wanted to focus on three local stories about people's experience of starting and sustaining community-led projects. Through highlighting some of the insights and lessons learned, the intention is that this compilation version will make some connections between themes and offer a quick way to be reminded of or acquainted with these hopeful local stories of people coming together for action and what they have learned that could be helpful to others. For folks who wish to hear the full episodes, they can be found at sharedground.ca or wherever you find your podcasts. For those of you who've already listened to the full episodes, I hope you'll enjoy hearing a shortened refresher of these stories and the inspiration they hold. Before I start the first clip, I wanted to let you know that later in this episode, I'll be reading a current update from Forest Protector Nina Newington regarding Lichen Camp, where a group of concerned people set up camp earlier this year in March of 2024 in order to protect an area of ecological significance and beauty known as Goldsmith Lake. During the second part of this episode, you'll hear some context and previous accomplishments relevant to this and other current protection efforts. But first, we'll start off on the South Shore in the Sebaganegdi District to hear from the Food Forest folks, which also has lessons that are applicable to any community effort working for the good of the whole. Here we are at Blue Nose Academy in Lunenburg, or Asegadig, at the Food Forest. I'm sitting with three members of the team here.
I'm Catherine Barrett. A food forest, it goes by several different names, and the idea has been around for a very, very long time. It really means just growing food in a way that mimics the way plants grow in nature. So working with nature rather than trying to subdue it or control it all the time. Yeah, it's built on connections and growing, as Teresa likes to say, growing systems rather than growing individual plants. So all of the plants work together.
My name is Teresa Quilty, and we conceived this project a few years ago now, and it's been a real pleasure to sort of see it come from an idea to fruition, and to also approach it very much not just the process of creating a food forest on school grounds, but also we see it as a community building project. And it's very much about bringing the community together, different people together, the school, the community of Lunenburg, the Mi'kmaq community, and people of all ages and backgrounds.
My name is Sean Feener. I coordinate Mi'kmaq services for the South Shore Regional Center for Education. So the name of the food forest is Ne'adach, and it refers to the sun coming out. I guess initially when we were thinking of the food forest and what that means for the community and the school and the students here, I thought that name was quite appropriate because it felt like the sun was coming out on Blue Nose Academy with such a beautiful forest that the students could access and be a part of and learn relationships through. And then also for the community being able to engage with the students and the school community and all of the connections that were going to be built from it. So that's what the name means and why it was chosen. I think food forests and forest gardens in general really incorporate indigenous concepts, in particular, because I am Mi'kmaq, the Mi'kmaq concept of Nedigalimk. And I think that this forest in particular is a really great example of how we are pulling from different perspectives and utilizing Eduwapdamunk in a positive way that the community can interact with and create relationships with. It's very visual, and it's not just a theoretical form of two-eyed seeing or multiple perspectives. It's a physical, visual, kind of tactile version of that concept. When you think of the concept of Nedigalimk, you think of, the four pillars being the four R's, the respect, relationship, responsibility, and reciprocity. And when we think of a food forest, each one of those beings in that forest connect in different ways to all the beings around them, including humans that are utilizing and becoming a part of the forest through relationship. So Nedigalimk is the basis of the food forest. And when we think of just any forest living around us, we truly are trying to mimic those relationships within a space that's somewhat confined, but still creating its own system. So we're basically creating a family that can exist with or without our interactions. So it's very closely tied to indigenous ways of being and knowing, and indigenous guiding principles that guide our choices and our interactions with the living world around us.
I heard you folks on the Coastal Villages radio station. Teresa, you said that it needs to have value and meaning for the whole community. Yeah, that sounds like it's of utmost importance, but not something that everyone always considers when they're starting a new thing.
I think virtually everybody that we spoke with in the town of Lunenburg, over the period of a year, had never heard of a food forest before. It never took people long, once they heard a description of it, to see their faces light up and see people say, oh, that makes so much sense, and it's really interesting, and it's exciting, and they just never thought of it, and get excited about the idea and really want to see it happen. So the process of talking about it for a long time before it physically began to take shape was a journey in itself of, I think, sparking people's imagination to think differently about these ideas of local food security, how we grow food, where our food comes, and then how we come together to create those food systems, and how we could come together to do that, and different ways of growing foods. So all of these ideas that we put out there, that we ourselves were learning about and exploring and still are, have somehow sparked a connection for so many people in the community. And so we have had dozens of people support us in this project. So I think one of the important connections that we've made is just with people who got excited about this idea, who for whom it was new and exciting, and they could find something that made sense for them. And that also included older generations of people who didn't come out and help us with the physical labor, but wanted to support the project in other ways, even baking cookies for the people who were out working, things like that. Because older people also really intuitively understood the importance for students, for young people to have this connection to nature and to each other through food and growing food. Yeah, so the web of connections that have formed through this project has just been so delightful, and it continues to be delightful, and it's wonderful to not exactly know what's going to happen next and who you're going to meet next. That's a really fun part of this web that we're creating in the community.
It's just so wonderful to have experiential, hopeful things happening where people can directly get involved and meet one another and meet, the other beings, the non-humans as well. I just feel like things like this are such a gift to the community and such a gift to the children who, I love how you said that, Sean, are going to grow up with this forest and see it and them and the relationships between everything like evolve over time. Like, that's just one of the most amazing things. And I know it's no accident. And you might want to talk a little bit about like how this began.
I think for us, for Teresa and I, the concept or the idea to do this came about during the pandemic when things were quite grim, and we would take walks together and just talk about how we're going to get through everything, just the pandemic, but everything else, climate change and biodiversity loss and so many things. And we kept coming back to the idea of community, meaning the community of people around us, but our relationship with all the beings, and that is what was going to get us through, not the government and not the businesses and not help coming in from somewhere else, but a strong community and a strong network here locally.
I seem to remember us saying something like, well, this sounds like it would be a hard project to pull off, but it might be worth it if we could get enough people interested. And it had to be worth it to us. We wanted to do, Catherine and I wanted to work on something that was going to selfishly reconnect us with members of the community, because we were feeling very isolated and ineffective. And the anxiety happens when you're worried, but you're not active. And so we wanted to take some practical, positive action. We wanted to actually physically do something that was creative and constructive. And it seems like it's both a solution if things go badly, and it's also a prevention. And that's just in terms of the food that it might produce. But also, I think having a healthy, resilient, connected community of people and all ages and different kinds of knowledge is so critical in all times, as prevention and as solution as well. So it just checked every box we could think of. And so we said, yeah, it's probably worth the effort to see if we can pull this off.
Yeah. I noticed you chuckle there, Sean, when she said something about, I hope we can pull this off.
I feel like there were a lot of unforeseen, not so much roadblocks, but barriers, certainly, in terms of like just availability of resources and that like human time in the beginning, and then being able to find available contractors to do some of the larger scale like groundwork. And yeah, I think it was there were so many barriers that I think everyone just kind of, you know, to get over them, everyone just didn't look at them as barriers and really saw the end goal. And if the team didn't do that, I don't think that the food forest would be planted today.
So that's reminding me that it might be good for folks to know, for might be interested in trying to start something like this in their own communities. You've probably learned a lot that could be useful for others.
Yeah, I think a lot. It seemed like there was a lot of talking going on before we actually did anything, which was, I mean, it could be criticized or it could be frustrating, but it was actually really necessary. Sean was, I think, the first person that we spoke with after the principal of the school, and many, many other people. And I think all of that is essential to get all the different points of view, so many different ideas about what the food forest is and should be. And it would have been a completely different project if we had gone in a couple of months with some backhoes and planted some trees. I think all of the networking and the talking conversations are critical before any planting happens.
Yeah, and all that extra time, you know, the delays and things, just actually, in every case, we learned something new. And so it has been an evolving project. It will continue to evolve. And yeah, it's been a really nice balance of having some goal and direction, but at the same time, letting it emerge and change and being flexible. We have plans to expand the food forest into another section and take back more of the lawn the mowed lawn area to make it more biodiverse and productive. And we have a plan for that, but it's but I feel like I'm learning to be more comfortable with not knowing exactly how it's going to go, and just trusting that we now have a really good group of people, and we continue to attract more input. And as long as we keep listening and responding, we seem to do okay. And so that's what we're going to keep doing.
Yeah, I would just say, you know, how drastically important it is to have community involvement and community engagement in the initial phases, and to be able to kind of keep that momentum going with the community, and further, even when the project is, quote, finished, unquote. It's never really finished, because it's a continually growing forest that's always going to be changing somewhat and growing. So when you first finish that initial, you know, ground moving, first plants in the ground, that's not the end of the community involvement. That's kind of right in the middle, where, you know, you start to see some of the plants being planted, and then you can continue to consult and grow your ideas and the plans around the forest and what can be added that has a benefit to everyone. So I think, you know, the involvement of the school here right next to the food forest, of the greater community in Lunenburg, and then just consultation with many different partners in the greater community is what really made this project move forward and not get stalled into a point where it just became not feasible to finish.
I just had an image pop up in my mind as you were saying that. This is probably an obvious analogy, but when I came to see it for the first time and found out that you'd only just like prepared the ground and planted it a couple of months before that, and it was incredible because it looks like, wow, it's already a forest, it's already a little community there, and it's not very old at all. And so then hearing about everything that happened ahead of time, it's like, oh, all this nourishment, you know, and mycelium were like connecting underneath the ground, and then suddenly this like beautiful mushroom pops up, and it looks like, oh, this mushroom just came out of nowhere, but the ground had been set for it to flourish.
Just another aspect of this project that, you know, if there are other communities or groups that are thinking of doing something like this, I would say that one of the beautiful things that I love about nature is that it's very forgiving also. And it also, you know, it does let us know when maybe if we're getting it wrong. And so, yeah, we try not to use the word wrong, I guess, or mistakes too much. But we have consulted with a lot of knowledgeable people and experts, and we're very fortunate on the South Shore of Nova Scotia to have so many knowledgeable people. I mentioned Rosemary Lonis from Helping Nature Heal joined our project last winter, and she's another person who made it possible for us to move forward. We would not have what we do in the ground without her help and guidance. She gave us some guidance on sort of the technical aspects of operationalizing this, and you know, so how do we sequence all the work and get it done? Who are some people who can help us? She has all these vast networks of landscaping people and resources. And I noticed that there were sometimes we had these great meetings with her and she was so helpful, but I found myself afterwards being paralyzed with fear that I was afraid to take the next step or actually do the thing that we talked about. And I voiced that to her at one point, and she just looked at me and kind of shook me and said, "It's okay, you can do it, and it's okay." And I did kind of shake myself out of it and realized afterwards, oh, that was great that I noticed that I was paralyzed with fear, because I think we can do that when we're trying to do something new, and we can overread. We can overstudy something to the point where we feel that I'm not expert enough. And one of the wonderful things about this experience and so many people who have gotten involved to help us has been that, yeah, we're all learning some things. There is science, there is traditional knowledge, there are tried, tested, and true methods that we can use. But at the same time, we don't have to be experts to plant plants, to work with nature, to grow food. These are all things that anybody can do. And the children went out and they did it, and with just a little guidance. So there are lots of resources out there. Do some homework. Do ask for help and guidance. But at the same time, go ahead and don't be afraid.
To hear more from Sean Feener, Teresa Quilty, and Catherine Barrett about the Nayadak Food Forest, check out the full episode from August 2023. The next story of action is about the Save Our Old Forests campaign, which started in Annapolis County, Keswickwick District, and has since spread across the province. This segment is from a conversation with Rob Bright in episode 11. I wanted to remind listeners that although the term clear-cutting isn't used anymore by government or industry, the practice is still occurring.
It seems to me like a lot of people care about these things and a lot of people want to help. And once they have a clear avenue for how to contribute, your like support comes pouring in. Is that what you're finding?
I think so. It just seems like there's more and more awareness about the trouble that's going on with forestry and how much trouble our forests are in and just how few old forests are left. And it seems like the awareness is growing quite quickly and quite steadily. So, I think we're sort of catching a bit of a wave here in terms of public awareness, and we just hope it keeps growing and that people don't just hear about it and become aware about it, but begin speaking up what they feel about it as well and getting more involved and demanding that government take action.
So this event, Save Our Old Forest, was a launch of this campaign. Maybe we could just back up a little bit and if you could tell us sort of the story about how that started.
Well, Laura and I both sit on the board for the Arlington Forest Protection Society, and we thought, you know, with some sponsorship from a nonprofit, maybe it would carry a little more legitimacy than just regular citizens trying to do something on their own. Mm-hmm. So we talked to the rest of our board, and they were happy to go forward with it. We came up with some money to help sponsor, just get it off the ground to begin with, some budget money, a bit of a donation, and some fundraising possibilities that we could follow up with. We all recognized that forestry in Nova Scotia is a bit out of hand and has been for a while in terms of espousing ecological forestry and saying that they're being environmentally good stewards when their actions say the exact opposite. So we've all been really, really passionate about trying to get something done.
And how did that society start in the first place?
All of the members that are board members right now, we all live on Hampton Mountain or in Hampton. And one day we drove down the road coming back home, and we just saw 100 acres of land being clear cut over about a week it took them to do. And it was just devastating to drive by that every day. So when Olga found out that the property next door to her property was being clear cut, she was beside herself with grief and frustration. And she posted on Facebook, you know, what am I going to do? What can we do? And the first thing I thought was contact the owner and see if he'd be willing to sell. So Chris went and met with the owner and negotiated a deal where he would be willing to sell it and save the forest and then leave it up to us to try and raise that money. So that's what we did. And it was over several months that I think over 215 or 20 people ended up donating. That's kind of how it started. And
so, yeah, just a group of people seeing something that didn't want to happen, didn't agree with, didn't match up with your values, and you found a way, like found your own solution, basically.
We found a way. I don't know how to explain it, but all of these people came together and said, we're going to donate money to save this piece of forest. And, you know, here we are. And so we thought we better put this forest into, register it as a not-for-profit and continue on the good work and run workshops out of it. And now the forest is called the Arlington Teaching Forest. And we have people come and do mycology workshops and tree identification workshops and bird workshops. And so it's just kind of expanded into kind of a public education and awareness society and all about nature and ecology and forest protection. And we're only 3 years old, so it's kind of moving quickly from, I mean, the first year we had one workshop, the second year we had six workshops, this year we have 15 workshops scheduled, and it just keeps kind of growing. Like, yeah, it's quite exciting.
Yeah, well, it's neat, isn't it? Like, it started with that, and then, like, you achieved your initial objective, and then you built on the momentum of it, and all sorts of other things now are happening sort of with that as the base.
Actually, we didn't even know this is what we were going to become. We just wanted, the initial goal was to save the forest, and that was kind of, I think, all that any of us had in mind, and mm-hmm. we had no idea we'd be running this many workshops out of it or attracting this much attention or getting involved in a campaign like the SOOF campaign, and that's all just kind of snowballed and happened on its own somehow.
Yeah. I believe that most Nova Scotians probably don't want the forest to disappear. They don't want the forest to be poisoned. You know, they care about these issues. They want a healthy environment for their children to grow up in and all these things. But I think many of us just feel overwhelmed, you know, and maybe at a loss for what we can do, or feel like there's no, you know, maybe have lost hope, or just feel like there's no, you know, there's no power. I mean, there's probably all sorts of different reasons why people don't do more, but I feel like that's a big part of it. So I feel like this campaign is really offering, well, hope for one thing about what can happen when groups of people come together for something that they care about. So I wonder if you want to say a little bit more about what you think people can do and how we can come together to tackle these huge, huge issues that can be so overwhelming.
Well, I'm for one, I was one of those people pulling my hair out and whining and complaining about how can this be going on and da 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 da, and not really being active in doing anything about it. It wasn't until something Nina Newington said. She said, you know, people can sit at home and complain and whine and carry on and just grieve about how horrible the situation is. But once you start getting out there and doing something about it, it just feels so much better. Just the fact that you're out there acting, taking action, whether it's public awareness and educating others, whether it's confronting government, whether it's addressing laws that need to be changed, whether it's addressing, you know, regulations in certain industries that need to be upheld. Just the acting part of it, just the taking action part of it. Suddenly you don't feel so overwhelmed and you're not pulling your hair out anymore. And the same things are going on, but the change is already happening. I mean, no individual, no one person is going to change anything, but certainly once the numbers get up there and you're no longer an individual and you have all of this support, that's got to raise some eyebrows in terms of government paying attention and industry finally being held accountable.
I guess I'm curious about sometimes when you're trying to work with a group of people, even if you all have good intentions and you like each other. Sometimes some of the difficulty arises from like interpersonal challenges or, you know, misunderstandings between people in the group. Or I'm just wondering if you've had to navigate anything like that for like people that are trying to work together. Do you have any tips or advice on how to like create a good working environment or how to like overcome any of those kinds of obstacles?
It's funny you should mention that. I would say beware of email and social media and any kind of textual communication where you're not actually sitting face to face in a room together talking about something, because boy, communication can go sideways just from an email where you think you've read tone into something that wasn't there, or another person reads tone into what you've said that wasn't intended. And yes, things can get kind of funky at times doing that. So I really like that most of the meetings that we have in the SOOF campaign, our committee, our working group, have been face-to-face meetings, and that we've been working together for a few years now. So getting to know each other's work style and how you behave and how you act in front of each other isn't so much a surprise. Sometimes you can have a group of people and there's maybe three or four or five of you, and then a new person joins into that working group. And they don't really know how you are all working together, and they're the new person. And it's really important that they be given some leeway and that they be sort of coached through, well, we've already been through this, that, and the other thing, so we don't need to rehash all that again. And it can certainly be difficult working with people of different personalities and different value systems who want the same things but don't necessarily want to get there the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And even thinking of different groups like ATV drivers and who want to drive on the trails, and hunters and fishers and hikers and campers. And there's so many people that share the woods and share the forests and want this to make sure that they stay there and protect them. But they don't necessarily agree on what each other is doing. Like, you shouldn't be riding your ATV in the middle of nature, or you shouldn't be hunting for whatever reason, or, you're overfishing our fish, or you're doing this, that, and the other thing.
Yeah.
But all of these people enjoy and appreciate nature and just being out in the middle of it. And if they started coming together and demanding that government stop clear cutting or stop spraying glyphosate on everything, there would be so much more support. There would be so much more power in that voice that isn't divided because they all do different things or appreciate nature for different reasons. Mm-hmm. The fact that we can all appreciate nature and share the bounty of what nature has to offer, it should really bring us together and not keep us divided.
Yeah, I completely agree. That's one of the reasons I actually started this podcast, because I was curious. Like, I thought, I keep thinking, well, so many people want what's good for, the rest of nature and want to respect the land that we're on and enjoy being outdoors. And, where do our shared values lie? Because there are a lot of more surface things that we could disagree upon or have misunderstandings with each other about. But if we could agree upon like what's really important deep down, I feel like almost all of us could say, yeah, of course, I agree with that.
I think it's really difficult, especially in this day and age where there's so much polarization, in politics. I mean, it seems to me that in politics, people used to be able to come together from different sides of the table or from different political parties and even, at least be civil and respectful and come to some sort of consensual agreement about how things are working. Nowadays, it just seems it's a lot of mudslinging, a lot of hurling of insults. And if you're in that camp, you're not in my camp, and we have nothing to say to each other. And I think that's terrible for our political system, also for our the way we live in our own regions and areas. We can't be so divided, I think, and even hope to get along on anything. It's a bit gloomy, but I think there are ways. I mean, no one wants to see the planet be destroyed. No one wants to see climate change meet its full. But certainly, I mean, I think most people, regardless of what political party you belong to or what political values you hold, most people agree that what we're doing is not good and that things need to change. I don't think we've agreed on how we can make those changes. We know that the climate crisis is also a biodiversity crisis, and that we're losing more and more of nature the longer that we go down this path. There's so many people that want to protect nature that it really shouldn't matter what the reason is that you want to protect it, as long as we protect it.
Right. So maybe even being more explicit with that outright when you talk to people and saying, we understand that we probably lots of things that we don't agree on, or we might go about things differently, but can we agree on this? Like, even just having an agreement right off the bat, maybe about like what is this thing that we agree on, and try to hold that at the forefront of our vision while we work together.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
I think it's always useful for each of us to remember that there are a lot of other people that care and that are trying to do things, and all the ways that people can contribute in different creative or seemingly small ways. And the more of us that do whatever it is that we do, obviously, the more that can shift over time. And so I feel like, your Arlington Forest Protection Society, like the story of how that started, and then what's come out of it, like with this campaign that you're working on, and just the different, all the different ways people can do things, whether it's starting up their own thing, like your group did, or supporting a group like yours that already exists in various ways. Like, there's so many ways that we can all help. And And feel this like greater sense of human community too when we come together to try to help solve some of the mess that we as a culture have gotten ourselves into.
I think that what grows out of Arlington Forest is just growing that group of committed people and taking on more and more things that need to be changed. I guess one of the things I take out of the Arlington Forest Protection Society experience is that average citizens can do something. You know, it doesn't take many of us.
Before the Save Our Old Forests campaign began, many people were combining their efforts to protect a particular forest known as Last Hope Camp, which was slated for harvesting, but where locals had seen at-risk species, including moose and wood turtle, and knew the ecological value of the forest. Through every kind of weather for over 6 months, beginning in December of 2021, rotating groups of campers protected the small area of forest and wetlands through direct action. In addition to the people spending overnights here, were hundreds near and far who also offered their energy and resources to saving this forest. Here is Nina Newington giving some context about the Last Hope Camp and the reasons for their protection efforts. This clip was taken at the camp, where Nina stayed through the winter when the fate of the forest was still unknown.
So, you know, here we are, a 24-hectare forest. Mm-hmm. That Westfall puts into cut when it was spared by the private landowner 20 years ago. Under the current system, you basically don't get any notice that these things are happening. So the local people who've loved and cared about this land for all of these years find is they see the flagging. They contact the Department of Natural Resources, who ignore them. When Randy went to DNR, they just blow him off. So he went to see our MLA, who then contacted DNR and was able to arrange a meeting. They basically said, well, there's nothing we can do, it's too late. It's like, well, it's not too late, they haven't cut it yet. Mm-hmm. But, oh, we've gone through our planning process, so it's too late. Mm-hmm. You know, call Westfall. So he called Westfall. Westfall didn't answer his call until Carmen Kerr intervened. Then Westfall said, oh, now it's too late. We're going to start cutting in the next 2 weeks. Which was the point at which Randy posted on Facebook at the end of November, and I happened to see those comments and contacted him and just thought, okay, you know, I live nearby. We know the South Mountain is getting just massacred mm-hmm. with clear cuts. And, you know, here's a chance to get in ahead of the equipment and say no. Like, you know, and then I met with him. And we came out here and he talked about this land and what he knew about it and the species at risk and how valuable it was. And I looked at the map of all the wetlands that are around it and how it connects them. And driving here, you can't exactly escape the fact that it's an island of 80-year-old trees in a sea of clear cuts. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like so much has been cut all around it. So, you know, it was like, well, actually, this is ridiculous. They're not planning on clear-cutting this, but they're planning on cutting it. They're planning on taking 30% of it, and that will additionally will be extraction routes into it, and that's going to destroy its value ecologically. And why? They should be putting this up for protection. They've said they're going to protect all this extra land, but they don't seem to be doing any of the kind of planning you would need to do where you first decide whether it should be cut before you decide how it should be cut. There's so many things that if we turned and said, wow, this is really an emergency, what can we do and what do we need to do right now and how are we going to muster the resources collectively to do this and engage people's energy and enthusiasm and sort of creative thought and willingness to do stuff, we could be turning towards a much, much nicer place to live. People need to feel respected, and that there's an element of, you know, if you're poor and working in Nova Scotia and scratching stuff together and trying to have whatever job you can get, and somebody who is perceived as coming in from the city is going, well, why don't you drive an electric vehicle? I mean, this is the caricature. Uh-huh. There's a lot of room in there for people feeling like, hey, you really don't get my life.
Right.
And you don't get what I'm up against. Mm-hmm. And I think that if we're going to make progress, we have to work at listening to each other and really recognizing what people are up against. You know, and that there's a lot of stuff that isn't easy, but it doesn't have to be solved by destroying nature. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be solved by making an uninhabitable planet.
Right.
None of those things are going to make it better. Mm-hmm. But doing the stuff that we need to do to address the climate crisis, to address biodiversity loss, actually also has the potential to make those things better. But there is a real need to listen and respect. And I think a lot of people feel not listened to and not respected. And it's, you know, it's not always easy work, right? But if we don't do that, we're going to end up in some bad dead ends. If people understood how much they're paying for clear-cutting, if we really say, whoa, okay, you've destroyed a natural carbon storage, it's the only really good technology we have, it's called trees, you know, they store carbon without having to get, you know, paid and have massive amounts of engineering done, and you've destroyed the natural ecosystems, which include what helps to shelter us from wind, what stops storms, what keeps water clean. Wow, that's quite a cost that we're all carrying for a few companies to make a buck on the last one they can squeeze out of the province's forests.
This last part of this compilation is from a celebratory event that took place at Last Hope Camp during the summer of 2022, where you will hear some of the folks involved talking about their experience. Due to the at-risk species of lichen that they found, the majority of the forest is now off-bounds to logging, and the forest protectors dismantled the camp and declared a win for the forest. This collaborative effort to protect this forest, of course, influenced other community efforts later on, such as the Save Our Old Forests campaign. You may hear sounds of the forest, the festivities, and the fire crackling. The first person we hear from is one of the citizen scientists who discovered some of the at-risk species of lichens that will help to protect this forest.
I made me cry. Well, it has given me a new purpose, and I feel like I've found my retirement niche because I was sort of, you know, looking for something and not really feeling like I was doing the thing that I was supposed to be doing because I didn't know what it was. And coming out here and meeting everyone and being able to share my knowledge and passion of the woods and seeing it help has been very rewarding. And just being around so many incredible, knowledgeable, inspiring, dedicated people has given me, you know, that oomph to keep going and do more, and instead of just sitting home and feeling helpless and hopeless, because, you know, sometimes that's how I felt, that there wasn't anything that I could do as one individual. And now I know that's not true. There's lots I can do. And so, yeah, it's been very empowering to me.
How has this experience being involved with Last Hope Camp affected you?
Oh, and it was just such fun to meet people who were keen and interested, but not rabid, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that that's something that's struck me by this whole effort. They were determined and informed, but not rabid. Anyone who came up and wanted to know what was going on was given a calm and rational description of why they were here, instead of short word answers and can't, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I just really think they're admirable for that.
How is this experience with the Last Hope Camp affected you?
Well, I think it has brought some hope back. Great. I think for myself and other people I've spoken to, it feels like there's been a little bit of a resurgence, and, you know, we can make a difference. We can be impactful. We can stand up for what we believe in and not get discouraged and, you know, be in despair. So this has been a really interesting opportunity for me to find other people I haven't worked with before or met before. So, yeah, I think it really helps us, people who are thinking about how we can be impactful. Last Hope has given us an opportunity to come together, meet each other. And for me, I have a group of people that I hang with in Pictou County, like a book club that I couldn't go to last night because I was here. But I told this group of 10 women who know probably most people in Pictou County, if you think of their connections and their relatives, I'm coming to Last Hope to celebrate what was accomplished, and I gave a little background of the lichen find and the fact that it looks very promising that West 4 won't cut, and that the next day we're going to be dismantling. So giving those people this opportunity to know about what was going on, you know, I think it gives them hope. You know, it's like a wave. It just keeps moving, and then people aren't so discouraged. So I think this is what Last Hope, the title is so ironic because it's given us hope.
How has this experience with the Last Hope Camp affected you?
In a positive way. I really appreciated the sense of community. And I've met a lot of good people, a lot of people who've come to camp who I will keep relationships going. And that is, to me, that's key in keeping this camp going this long is the people and our determination and feeling like we're working together. And whatever part I can take being here is really important to me. Mm-hmm. It's rewarding, fulfilling. And there's a hermit thrush.
Okay, I was just going to ask.
Piping up.
Yeah, so how has being involved in the Last Hope Camp affected you?
So for me, the camp was an opportunity to, in some small way, you know, raise awareness, change things, try to get people to listen. Mm-hmm. And it's frustrating. It's really frustrating. Because I talk to people, even around me, friends and associates, and they go, oh, yeah, it's great that you're doing that, but, like, you know, that kind of a waste of time, isn't it? Like, do you really think you can change anything? So the camp has been really positive, just being with these people who are open-minded and really want to help change things. So it's been supportive for me.
I am a firm believer that no action is worthless, that everything, if you do it with the right intentions, it will eventually bear fruit. It's just that it's glacial slowness, especially in the beginning.
I think this would be a good spot to return to current times and give you the update from Nina Newington that I mentioned earlier. Similar to what was Last Hope Camp is now another protection camp set up in an area not too far away, known as Lichen Camp, at Goldsmith Lake. Hopefully they will manage a similar good outcome to that of Last Hope Camp, and perhaps you were able to lend a hand in some way. What I'm about to read now are Nina's words from just a couple of days ago, on April 11th, 2024, about what's going on there. Save Our Old Forests and citizen scientists have been working hard to protect the area of Crown land around Goldsmith Lake in Annapolis County. In spite of adverse public comments, in 2022, Department of Natural Resources, DNRR, approved logging plans for 462 hectares around the lake. Later that year, the citizen scientists submitted a proposal to protect the Goldsmith Lake wilderness area. By March of last year, we had identified 17 species at-risk occurrences in cut blocks that DNRR had approved for logging. We learned to our relief that holds had been placed on all the harvest plans touched by species at risk. But a year later, and in spite of our having doubled the number of species at risk occurrences we had identified, DNRR failed to respond when asked if the holds were still in place. Finding equipment widening a road to access cut blocks that had been on hold confirmed our fears. On Saturday, March 2nd, 2024, a loose collection of people who have been working to protect the proposed wilderness area set up Lichen Camp on a logging road at the north end of the cut blocks. Citizen scientists in the meantime identified more species at risk occurrences nearby. On Monday morning, a truck pulled into the camp at 6 a.m., turned around and left, only to return at 9 a.m. the logging contractor and a West 4 representative had a civil conversation with the campers. They confirmed that they would not be back to camp to cause trouble, and we confirmed we would not try to stop them finishing up cuts they had begun a year ago, further to the west. We have also had a friendly visit from local DNRR. There was some talk of issuing us a permit. Lichen Camp has been in place for over 40 days. Without it, it is clear that logging would have begun in parts of these cut blocks. The ecological, Nina has that in quotation marks, the ecological harvest prescriptions approved for the area all call for removing 50% or more of the forest. The 30-meter-wide logging road West 4 punched through the forest back in 2022 gives an accurate idea of the kind of, quotes again, light-touch forestry they had in mind. Fortunately, this forest protection and education camp is here and serving as a base for research. As the weather and the roads improve, we will host workshops and guided hikes. In the next few weeks, Mi'kmaq youth from Bear River First Nation will be coming to Goldsmith to experience both the old-growth forest we have identified and DNRR has confirmed, as well as a culturally important and endangered black ash. Camping at the end of a ferocious wind tunnel has its moments, but spirits are good. We welcome campers, visitors, and donations. Please email lichencamp@gmail.com. You can also check out Friends of Goldsmith Lake on Facebook. And please write to Minister Hellman and Minister Rushton. Join us on calling on the government to grant the proposed Goldsmith Lake Wilderness Area interim protection from logging, road building, and any other industrial activity while decisions are made about which areas will be protected permanently as part of the province's commitment to protect 20% of the province by 2030. So that was from Nina, sent to me just a few days ago. And if you didn't catch the email address regarding offering help to the Lichen Camp, or would like the addresses of the politicians she urged folks to write to, I'll put those in the show notes. Also, I'll link there to some Earth Day events you may be interested in, one hosted on April 20th by Neadach Food Forest in Lunenburg, and others on the 21st in the Valley and Halifax through Save Our Old Forests. Other upcoming SOOF events include a citizen science workshop in Bedford, a SOOF info session and open house at the Deanery Project, and medicinal plant walks and birding workshops at Goldsmith Lake. Upcoming event details can be found at saveouroldforests.ca. We'll wrap up this episode now by traveling back to 2022 to hear Nina's voice over the phone shortly after the success of protecting the Last Hope Forest, just following the summer celebration at Last Hope Camp. I think that no matter the ongoing challenges that we face, the underlying message you'll hear from Nina gets to the heart of things and can guide us in our efforts in action and collaboration.
We don't have to know how it's all going to work out. You know, we didn't know what the end was going to be of the camp. We responded to the situation and said, well, this is the next right thing to do. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to go and get in the way and see what happens. And I don't think any of us would have guessed that we'd be there through that whole long, unexpectedly brutal winter. Or really had an idea how it was going to end, because we don't have that kind of control. And that's sort of true for all of us right now. We don't know how it's going to end, but it's worth starting. Mm. And seeing where things go and following the leads and the help that comes. And you can't guarantee anything will succeed. But if you don't do it, you can guarantee you won't succeed. So that part just feels really great, you know, likens to the rescue. Who knew?
I'd like to repeat Nina's words here, as it is an important thread between these stories of action. We don't know where it's going to end, but it's worth starting. Thank you for listening to Shared Ground. Until next time, fellow humans. ¶¶